among the reed beds of the Suffolk coast. Over 2 weeks, we bring you some choice concerts from the festival, with a focus on British music in the first week, including works by Britten, Walton and Grace Williams. And In Tune will be joining the fun with exclusive performances from a range of festival stars on Friday evening at 5. Radio 3 at the Aldborough Festival begins on Tuesday evening at 7 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's midday, time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the children's author Francesca Simon.
Anyone who's spent any time with children in the last 30 years will know who I'm talking about when I say the names Horrid Henry and his brother Perfect Peter. They're the creations of my guest today, Francesca Simon, and they've appeared in 25 books, been translated into 31 languages, and sold 25 million copies. In a way, without wanting to sound unduly pretentious, for this is Radio 3, they seem to embody archetypes. The chaotic, naughty brother, who's always in trouble, and the neat, well-behaved sibling, who's always anxious to please the parents. Now, which character you identify with probably says a lot about you, and I hope to discover which you think you are, Francesca Simon. But before we find that out, I should also mention your latest project, because it reveals your deep engagement with music. It's a libretto for a new cantata by the young British composer Gavin Higgins, The Fairy Bride, which opens in the Aldborough Festival next week and will be broadcast on Radio 3. In fact, I can see Gavin Higgins on your list for today, Francesca, along with Bach, Mozart, Tchaikovsky, and a Breton folk song. But we're going to start with Yiddish music. And this connects, I think, with your childhood and family.
Yes, it does. I've always really loved folk music. Bob Dylan, Joan Baez. And I became kind of obsessed with this album by Theo Bekel of Yiddish folk songs. I never knew what any of them were about, but I just used to listen to them again and again and again. I am Jewish, and I'm also from, my family's from East European, Lithuania, Poland, Russia. And these songs are very much kind of rooted in that place. So there's something possibly ancestral about my love for these particular songs.
Tell us, Francesca, what the words mean. I think they're quite subversive, really.
Well, the song mostly seems to be an argument about science versus religion until you get to the end and suddenly you move onto a different plane of belief, where instead of arguing, the rabbi just goes to heaven and eats his dinner.
Oma Herr, du Philosoph, mit dein kurzen Meichu, und setz dich zu zum Rebenstisch, der Fest lernen es Eichu. Yam bam bam bam, yam bai bam bam, yam bam bam bam, bam bai bam. Yam bam bam bam, yam bai bam bam, yam bam bam bam, bam bai bam. Adam Schiffost, du ois geklärt, und nimm sich mit dem Iber. Der Rebbe spreit sein Tichel ois, und spann dem Jammer Iber. Jam-ba-ba-bam, jam-ba-ba-bam, jam-ba-ba-bam-ba-ba-bam. Jam-ba-ba-bam, jam-ba-ba-bam, jam-ba-ba-bam-ba-ba-bam. Aluf Ballon, hast du uns getracht,
und meinst, du bist auch horretz. Der Rebbe spott, der Rebbe lacht, er darf es auf Kapores. Jam bom bom bom, bom 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 bom, jam bom bom bom, bom bom bom. Yum bum bum yum bum bum yum bum 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 bum. So weißt du was der Rebbe tiet, beschasser sitz bich ich des. In ein Minut er in Himmel flieht und prave dort schalasch ich des. Yam bam bam bam, yam bay bam bam, yam bam bam bam, bam bay bam, yam bam bam bam, yam bay bam bam, yam bam bam bam, bam bay bam.
I could see that was tugging at your heartstrings as we listened to it, Francesca Simon.
I love that song so much, and I think the words are irrelevant. If you just listen to the music, it's very moving. It's, you know, you can feel the weight of history in that song.
It's quite a catchy tune as well.
Yes, well, that's probably why I was obsessed with it and played it so many times, wore the record very thin.
Come here, you philosopher, Theodore Bickel. You were saying, Francesca, that you listened to that song all the time as a teenager. As your voice reveals, you were brought up in America, and your father, Mayo Simon, was a screenwriter in Hollywood in the early 60s. So what kind of childhood did that give you?
Well, it gave me a Hollywood childhood without being a Hollywood child, because the daughter of a screenwriter is pretty low. On the pecking order. But my dad wrote several films, including Judy Garland's last film, I Could Go On Singing. He wrote Marooned. And several, of course, many, many scripts that never got made, but enabled us to live in Malibu on the beach.
It sounds like a bit of an idyll, but a bohemian one.
It was bohemian in the sense that it was very casual. You know, I never wore shoes. There were a lot of film stars who lived there, but it was ramshackle. I mean, they were little houses, except that I lived across the street from Lana Turner, who had one of the only big houses there. I, of course, had no idea who she was, but my mother was beside herself. I thought, who is this middle-aged housewife that my mother is so excited about, who seemed to have very bad taste in husbands? Even I could see that. But she was very friendly and used to invite us in to come swim in her swimming pool. I think she enjoyed having children around. She enjoyed the company. The other thing about her that was always striking to me was that in her house, she had a telephone on every table. And this was at a time when there was one phone per house. So I'd never seen anybody with so many telephones. That impressed me more than it was Lana Turner. But you know, people like Larry Hagman and Burt Lancaster, Linda Ronstadt, all lived there, but in a very low-key way. None of the houses were closed off from the beach. They are now, but it was all very open, so people kind of spilled out onto the beach. But I didn't know that this wasn't a normal life. I didn't really have any comparison. I thought maybe this was America.
It was because of one of your father's projects, Judy Garland's last film, that you all arrived in England. You were six. Quite a transition from Hollywood. And from then on, you moved back and forth between California and England and Paris. It all sounds like an extraordinary life, glamorous, jet set. But what did you make of it at that age, still quite a tender age? Did it mean in some ways that you had to grow up quite fast?
Well, it was hard because I kept starting at a school and then being yanked out. And also when we moved to Paris, I didn't speak French, which I learned very quickly because I was just put into the local French school. I mean, in a way, it's probably why I live in Europe now. But at the time, it was hard because you never knew when you were going to be removed from where you were living. And I think the move to Malibu, which my parents were renting a house, was the idea was that we'd be there for 6 months and then we'd go back to New York. And of course, we never left.
It's from the Californian phase of your childhood that we find our next music. Something you played as a child in the school orchestra, Bach's Double Violin Concerto. And in particular, you wanted to hear the Yasha Heifetz version.
I did. I played violin. And I had a very good friend who lived nearby, and she lived next door to Yasha Heifetz. And he was always complaining that we were making too much noise. I was about 10 years old, and he would either shout at us to be quiet, or he would phone my friend's mother and say that he was resting or he was studying, and could we please be quiet, which I thought was really annoying because I mean, I knew he was a violinist, but I didn't really know anything about him, just that he was quite frightening. And I just thought it was wrong to tell people at 3 in the afternoon that they were making too much noise jumping on a trampoline.
Well, despite that, you've forgiven the maestro, and you want to hear him playing now both parts in a recording from 1946. Basically, he played one and then listened to a playback with headphones and played the other part on a double track. Not always perfectly in sync somehow.
Yeah, I wanted to hear this, even though I think it's an imperfect recording, because what Yasha Heifetz gains in speed, he loses in the conversation with another performer. There's no sense that they're talking to each other. He is talking to himself.
It becomes a monologue rather than a duet.
Absolutely. I am in awe of the speed in which he's playing, even though I think he's playing it too fast, and there's something sort of show-offy about it. Thank you. Yeah, I can still, it still come, this piece really brings it back to me, remembering Yasha Heifetz playing by the open window as we were, you know, quietly jumping on the trampoline.
The first movement of the Concerto for Two Violins in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach, with Yasha Heifetz playing both solo parts. Franz Waxman was conducting the RCA Victor Chamber Orchestra. You continued playing the violin? Do you still play the violin?
No, I had to stop playing because I got terrible RSI. I mean, crippling RSI. I couldn't write for about 5 or 6 months. So I, unfortunately, I had to stop. But to make up for it, I've taken up the banjo, which has no RSI issues.
And do you play the Bach double violin concerto on the banjo?
I'm pretty much on boil dem cabbage down level.
But it's not banjo next, but it is a Breton folk song that you've chosen by the folk singer Alan Stivell. And again, I think this comes from your high school days.
It does. There was an exchange student at my high school named Gérard Bescon, and he was from Brittany, and he introduced me to this Celtic Breton singer, and I was absolutely mesmerized, and I instantly went out. I bought several LPs, but we recently went to Paris to see him in his full glory playing with a Breton symphony. I love traditional folk instruments, and he is just magnificent. Again, I had no idea what the words were about until actually looking them up for this program, because I think it's interesting. You know, I'm a writer, and I should be very interested in the words. But for these kinds of pieces, you don't need to know the words. There's this yearning quality to his music and to playing these kind of traditional instruments. And I'm not that surprised about what the song is about. You know, it's about a shepherd boy who's in love with the youngest daughter of the seigneur. And the song is not going to go where you think it's going to go. But basically, his parents want him to be a priest. She begs him not to do it. He becomes a priest and she kills herself.
So it's quite a dark song.
But folk music is dark. Folk music is dark. But just hearing him play the harp, which is his prime instrument, to me, I could just listen to him all day.
Agar a blevan Bach nie
Alan Stivell with Genoveva from 1974. It's interesting that we've had three pieces of music so far, Francesca Simon, which go way back to your early life. And I'd like to explore that just a bit more, because after all, your Horrid Henry books make you one of the most successful children's writers ever. How much do you think you're drawing on that childhood and your own sibling relationships?
I mean, inevitably, yes, I'm the eldest of four. I always wanted to be an only child. And also, I think because I was someone who was really well behaved at school. I mean, I just, you know, girly swat absolutely sums up who I am. And then at home, I was slamming doors and screaming and yelling. And I think that Horrid Henry and Perfect Peter are two sides of everybody. But it was funny to divide them in two. I mean, this is not a conscious thing. You know, I'm writing something that I hope is amusing.
Oh,
but,
it is, yeah.
Yeah, but I started thinking about, you know, when the fourth book came out, Horrid Henry's Knits, and they started to become very popular, I started to think about why are these books you know, why are these books really touching a chord with all kinds of people from all over the world? What is it about them? And I realized it was the fact that they're archetypes, but also the fact that everybody identifies with these two. And parents, it really brings out the child in them, because parents don't like Perfect Peter. And I always thought that they would, because the joke for him is he's the child that we're all socializing our children to be. He just obeys everything. Parents don't like him. The child in them revolts against someone who is so obedient. The anarchic energy of Henry is what touches people.
It would be lovely to hear you reading a little bit of Horrid Henry's Perfect Day, perhaps just the opening.
I will. This was actually the very first Horrid Henry story I ever wrote, and I also thought this was going to be a standalone story, but here goes. Henry was horrid. Everyone said so, even his mother. Henry threw food, Henry snatched, Henry pushed and shoved and pinched. Even his teddy, Mr. Kill, avoided him when possible. His parents despaired. "What are we going to do about that horrid boy?" sighed Mum. "How did two people as nice as us have such a horrid child?" sighed Dad. When Horrid Henry's parents took Henry to school, they walked behind him and pretended he was not theirs. Children pointed at Henry and whispered to their parents, "That's Horrid Henry! He's the boy who threw my jacket in the mud! He's the boy who squashed Billy's beetle! He's the boy who..." Fill in whatever terrible deed you like. Horrid Henry was sure to have done it. Horrid Henry had a younger brother. His name was Perfect Peter. Perfect Peter always said, "Please and thank you." Perfect Peter loved vegetables. Perfect Peter always used a hanky and never, ever picked his nose. "Why can't you be perfect like Peter?" said Henry's mum every day. As usual, Henry pretended not to hear. He continued melting Peter's crayons on the radiator. But Horrid Henry started to think. "What if I were perfect?" thought Henry. "I wonder what would happen."
I don't want to spoil the story, which you tell so wonderfully, but what happens next really does turn the world upside down. Nothing works in that family at all when Horrid Henry decides not to be horrid. So the message of the story, in one sense, is that every family needs an anarchist.
Well, I think it's also that parents divide their children into the good child and the bad child, even if they don't realize they've done it. And if you ask anyone, were you the good child or the bad child in your family, they always know who they were. So these roles kind of come preordained. I think that Henry is that kind of creative impulse that we all sort of nurture, that everyone has that desire, that almost creative energy. The one that wants to build the castle, that's Peter, and then the one that wants to stomp on the castle. And he gives in to all those impulses that we've all been socialized to control.
But you were somewhat ambidextrous, weren't you? Because
I was.
You were perfect at school and horrid at home.
Yes, but I also am really aware of my memory for the emotions of childhood is very acute. And I feel these things really strongly, even today, that feeling of injustice, the feeling that someone is getting something that you aren't, what it feels like to be the eldest and have to put up with younger siblings, and also the expectation of parents that their eldest child is going to be more grown up than they are, because they need them to be, because they can't cope. I realize that as an adult, but as a child, it seems very unfair. You're a little child, and yet your parents are saying, oh, let her have the doll. You know, you be the grown-up. And you're basically thinking, I'm 5 years old. I want that doll. Why should she have it?
Is there any naughty thing Horrid Henry can't do in the books? Are there limits in your mind?
Yes, of course. I mean, Henry gives the illusion of great wickedness, but in fact, he doesn't do anything that every child in the world hasn't done, hasn't called names or pinched. He never, you know, climbs up to the roof and says, aha, here are the matches. I think I'll just burn the house down. That would be really bad. And in fact, people have told me stories of things that they did that I would never put in a Horrid Henry book. They were much too dreadful. So
health and safety haven't been on your tail.
No, but I, like I say, if you look at the books carefully, you can see that there's actually nothing in there that every child hasn't done. But it always amuses me. Sometimes parents say to me, oh, you know, I had to stop my child reading Horrid Henry because, you know, they did this and that. And it's always the parents haven't read the books and the child has found a perfect get out excuse. You know, oh, well, Henry did that. I'm thinking, no, he never did. Your child is really yanking your chain.
Tchaikovsky next, Francesca, and Eugene Onegin. You say this opera, and particularly the singer, Dmitri Forostovsky, had a transformative effect on you, so that you actually fell in love with the opera, and maybe Forostovsky as well.
Oh, yes. Oh, are you kidding? Well, I never really was interested in opera, but I met John Full James, who was then the associate director of the Royal Opera House. And he turned out to be a Horrid Henry fan. And he said, well, you know, if you ever come up with an idea for an opera, get in touch. And I remember thinking, yeah, right, as if. I've seen 5 operas in my life. I don't really care for this art form. But, you know, thank you, John. And then 2 years later, I was writing The Monstrous Child, and which was about Hel, the Norse goddess of the dead, which I wrote with Gavin Higgins. But the Royal Opera House, I don't know, I was honest with them and said, look, after they commissioned this, I don't know very much about opera, but, you know, I know about writing picture books and I know the music has to lead. And I thought, well, I've got to educate myself. So they let me come to all the dress rehearsals. And Dmitri Vorostovsky walks out and with this shock of white hair and starts to sing. And I just can't believe what I'm seeing and hearing. And then I didn't know that opera could be like subtle and emotional and far from being ridiculous. I thought opera was about, you know, 50 dancing peasants and that it was overblown and silly.
But to add to the poignancy, of course, Horostovsky died very young, quite recently.
He did. I mean, I am so fortunate that he turned up for the dress rehearsal for a role that he had sung so many times. He was between cancer treatments, and so he was performing in between. He had a brain tumor, which was astonishing that he was doing this and that he was so marvelous. So I was overwhelmed by this.
Thank you.
Dmitri Vorostovsky with that aria from the first act of Eugene Onegin by Tchaikovsky. Kirill Petrenko was conducting a live recording with the Vienna State Opera, and the soprano was Olga Guryakova. And you can find details of all the choices of my guest today, Francesca Simon, if you go to the Private Passions webpage, and there are also hundreds of programmes on BBC Sounds. You didn't start writing, Francesca, until you had a child of your own, your son Josh. This was after studying medieval literature and then some years working as a journalist. What effect did it have on your son, I wonder, having a fictional brother? He must get asked about Horrid Henry all the time.
Well, Josh, I mean, in a way, fortunately, that by the time that the books became really well known, Josh was slightly above the age where his contemporaries were reading them. So if 7-year-olds were reading Horrid Henry, Josh probably was 9 or 10. So I think he's always really enjoyed it, even though we did used to joke about the fact that the children of well-known children's writers often come to a really bad end, which we both found funny, our strange sense of humor. But, you know, A.A. Milne's son and you know, the J.M. Barrie's, the boys that he adopted, and Kenneth Graham's sons. So not an illustrious tradition. And Josh used to do journalism as well, and he wanted to write an article about what it felt like to be part of this grim tradition.
Have you finished with Horrid Henry now, or were you continuing with it?
Well, I've written 25 books and 100 stories.
Gosh.
So I have, for the moment, stopped. I've been working on a new series called Two Terrible Vikings. So basically, two terrible children in Viking times.
But also, I imagine that the success of Horrid Henry has bought you the freedom to do what you want.
Completely, because I'm in the really fortunate position of earning royalties from Horrid Henry. And it does absolutely let me write what I want, to take the time. That's why I've so enjoyed collaborating with the composer Gavin Higgins on our new project, which is the cantata The Fairy Bride.
Well, writing librettos will not probably be quite as lucrative, I can tell you this from personal experience as a composer, as Horrid Henry. But in learning how to write a libretto, I think Mozart taught you one or two things.
Mozart taught me a lot. You know, particularly, you know, my next choice, which is from The Marriage of Figaro, because one of the things I was trying to understand about writing a libretto was about repetition, about the fact that you also have to say something many times. But how do you do that in a way that's not annoying? You know, I love him. Did I tell you that I love him? Mm. Everybody now, I love him. Mm. And this beautiful, beautiful aria from The Marriage of Figaro, you know, first of all, it's a dictation. It's a letter. I always like letter scenes. But so you have an excuse for the repetition because one person is dictating a letter to another. And I love people singing together. I like that kind of conversation. But the thing that really struck me about this piece was that it takes over 2 minutes, and it's 6 lines. Mm. And it's the setup for both the Countess and Susanna are both being betrayed by the Countess's horrible husband. Well, Susanna's not being betrayed, but their lives are being essentially made miserable by this man. And they set up a plot to catch him out. But they could have done this in 2 lines. Tell him you'll meet him in the garden, Susanna, and I'll do the rest. Okay, cool. I mean, that could be the scene. Instead, they spend 2 minutes singing 6 lines. And in that, it gives you the time, both as an audience, well, A, to hear how beautiful it is, but also to really think about the sadness, essentially, of this situation.
It's deeply ironic, in one sense, because they don't really mean a word of it.
No, I mean, they're tricking him, but they're saying, you know, come and meet me in the garden, you know, with the beautiful breeze. And then they both go, yeah, he'll get the message. Yeah, he'll get the message. Mm-hmm. Yep, he'll get it. But just this extraordinary music that goes with, and again, it's almost a counterpoint to the words, which is also kind of exciting.
Thank you.
Barbara Bonney and Arline Auger as Susanna and the Countess in that duet from Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. Arnold Erstmann was conducting the orchestra of the Drottningholm Court Theatre. Lorenzo da Ponte, who wrote the libretti to those Mozart operas, was brilliant, wasn't he? Do you think he's one of the best librettists of all time?
I think he's an absolute genius, and thank you for mentioning him, because usually no one ever mentions the poor librettist. And da Ponte was just such a wild man. If I had a quarter of his life, you know, that he was, his background is just is unreal. You know, he was born Jewish. He became a Catholic priest. Then he got kicked out of Venice for being so immoral, and he was living in a brothel and handling all the entertainments there. I mean, can you imagine what he was up to get banished for 15 years? And then he went to New York and worked in a grocery shop.
And
then
a deli.
And a deli. And then was instrumental in building the first opera house there. That's the most perfect example of kind of words and music working together just so, so beautifully.
A very different sensibility now, but another interesting musical figure, someone I know you really admire. I'm not going to say the name of the composer because I know you like to play this to people and ask them to guess who wrote it.
I do, because I have a lot of musician friends and no one has ever guessed correctly.
Well, I'm sure our many listeners will spot it, or at least some of them. Well, Francesca, we have to let people know who that was now. It's got real guts to it, and I think that's what might mislead some people. What do people normally say when they...
People guess, but always with a question mark. No one is ever sure, but people guess Delius or Vaughan Williams or, with a frown, Ravel?
Well, Francesca, let's put people out of their agony. Who was it?
It was the magnificent E.J. Murren, who deserves to be so much better known. But he has that yearning quality. And again, this piece is something I come back to again and again and again.
He was a pupil of John Ireland after the First World War. Sadly, he became an alcoholic and died in 1950. But he was strongly influenced by the folk music of England and Ireland.
He was 27 when he wrote it. He probably hadn't started drinking so much. I mean, it kind of breaks my heart that people don't know him, because I do think his music is wonderful and really deserves to be rediscovered, and also, you know, be much more part of the British canon. You know, when people play Vaughan Williams, I personally think he should be up there.
The Magini Quartet, with music from the first movement of the String Quartet No. 1 in A minor by Ernest Morin. We've been saying, Francesca, that you've been working with the composer Gavin Higgins on a new cantata, The Fairy Bride. It's based on an old folk tale about a supernatural woman who marries a mere mortal, but then gets into trouble by breaking all the rules of good behaviour. So she's got a touch of Horrid Henry about
her. I don't know about that. She's a fairy, so she's not breaking any rules. She's just being true to her fairy self. Gavin and I both really love myth. We love fairy tale. I knew Gavin slightly, but not well, but I knew his music when we collaborated on Monstrous Child. And I always say, you know, in terms of this program, you know, Gavin is a public passion of mine, not a private passion, because I think Gavin is an absolute genius. And I love working with him.
Well, tell me about this piece that we've chosen.
Well, it's from Gavin's his album called Ecstasis, which is, he was looking at different forms of ecstatic experience. And this, because we like myth, I chose, it's called We Turn to the Gods and Are Torn Apart. And this is the Dionysian followers who are whipped, who he whips to a frenzy. And Agave ends up ripping apart her own son. And in this music, you can feel this kind of dance getting more and more and more out of control.
A whirligig.
It is a whirligig, but it also has a hunting quality.
This string sextet was composed in 2019, Ecstasis, and it's called We Turn to the Gods and Are Torn Apart. And sadly now, Francesca, we must be torn apart. But thank you very much for a fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute joy.
Thank you. The Piatic Quartet, joined by David Cohen and Sarah Roberts, in music from Ecstasis by Gavin Higgins. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Francesca Simon. And you can hear Gavin Higgins and Francesca Simon's new cantata, The Fairy Bride, broadcast live from the Oldeburg Festival next Friday, 17th of June, at 7:30 p.m. here on BBC Radio 3. Private Passions was produced by Elizabeth Burke, and it was a Loftus Media production. This is BBC Radio 3 on 92.93 FM, on digital radio, online and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Vijay Alice. The Trades Union Congress says government plans to allow agency workers to fill in for striking railway staff are a desperate attempt to distract people from its numerous failings. The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, said the proposals would minimise the disruption caused by future train strikes but would not affect stoppages scheduled for later this month. The TUC Deputy General Secretary, Paul Nowak, said bringing in less qualified staff would create genuine safety risks. The Competition and Markets Authority has said it's ready to carry out a review of rising petrol prices. The business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, has asked the authority to investigate whether retailers have passed on the government's 5p fuel duty cut to consumers. The cost of filling an average family car with petrol hit £100 for the first time last week. The Northern Ireland Secretary, Brandon Lewis, says legislation giving ministers the power to scrap parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol will not breach international law. The government will introduce the bill tomorrow as part of its efforts to reduce checks on the movement of goods across the Irish Sea. The president of Sinn Féin, Mary Lou McDonald, said Mr. Lewis was talking through his hat. Campaigners with disabilities are taking legal action against the government after it decided not to back a key recommendation of the Grenfell Tower public inquiry, which would have provided vulnerable residents living in high-rise buildings with personal evacuation plans. They have accused the Home Secretary, Preeti Patel, of betraying the victims of the disaster ahead of its fifth anniversary on Tuesday. 15 of the 37 disabled people living in the tower died in the fire. Ministers said the proposals were not practical or safe. The first of the former McDonald's restaurants in Russia have reopened under a new name in Moscow, which translates as tasty, and that's it. The American fast food chain pulled out of the country last month following the invasion of Ukraine. Finally, the weather this afternoon will be cloudy and breezy in the north with some showers. There'll be patchy cloud and sunny spells elsewhere with the best of the sunshine in the southeast. Highs of 22 in London and 16 in Edinburgh and Belfast. That's the BBC News and weather at 1:02.
Night Tracks with me, Hannah Peel, and Sarah Moore-Peach. A space to relax, tune out everyday life, and really listen.
Come with us on an immersive adventure in sound. Together, we'll weave through a millennium of music, from works on the cutting edge to sonorous medieval chant, following wherever our ears take us.